Commentary. The Heart Sutra is so called because it constitutes the heart or essence of the Pranayaparamita, giving us in a highly condensed form the essential meaning of all the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. It is no wonder that in the Mahayana Buddhist countries of the East it is recited and chanted so often. If we really know the Heart Sutra, we know, in a sense, everything. There are two recensions of the Hridaya or Heart Sutra in the original Sanskrit, the only difference between them being that the longer one provides, both at the beginning and at the end, an account of the circumstances in which it was delivered. We are using the shorter and more popular version, and I have chosen the translation by Dr. Konza with slight emendations of my own, because it is the most literal. As regards the text itself, I'm going to make a suggestion that has not, so far as I know, been made before. I suggest that in the Heart Sutra, form and content, that is, the literary form and the spiritual content, are of equal importance. The form of the sutra is in reality part of the content. We might even say that in the case of the Heart Sutra, the medium is the message. The frame is really part of the picture. This frame or medium takes the form of a drama. The sutra is a sort of dialogue which takes place between Avalokiteshvara and Sariputra. If we understand who these characters are and what they represent, then we will understand a very great deal of the meaning of the sutra. Avalokiteshvara is one of the great bodhisattvas. In the highest sense, a bodhisattva is an embodiment of one special aspect of Buddhahood, and the aspect which Avalokiteshvara represents in this context is perfect wisdom. This might seem surprising. Usually he embodies compassion, while it is Manjushri who represents wisdom. But any bodhisattva can, as an enlightened being, an emanation of the Dharmakaya, do anything. Perhaps this reversal of our expectations serves to remind us that a bodhisattva is not limited to the expression of one particular quality. On the other hand, it may be that Avalokiteshvara was such a popular bodhisattva that he played a prominent part even in those situations for which his association with compassion did not particularly qualify him. Ultimately, of course, wisdom and compassion are inseparable. Through wisdom, one knows reality. Through compassion, one makes it known to others. Wisdom is here emphasized in the content of the text, compassion in the symbolism of the figures involved in the dialogue. The name Avalokiteshvara means the Lord who looks down, and at the beginning of the sutra, out of the depths of his perfect wisdom, he is looking down in compassion on the world, especially on Shariputra. Historically, Shariputra is one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, the other being Maha Modgalyayana. While Maha Modgalyayana was famous for his psychic powers, Shariputra was famous for his wisdom. But as, according to tradition, Shariputra was the founder of the Abhidharma, in the context of the Heart Sutra, he stands for wisdom in a limited Hinayana sense. So at once we have a clue to the meaning of the whole work. It is a dialogue between wisdom on the one hand and perfect wisdom on the other. But it is not just a dialogue, it is a tension, even a clash. But how is it there should be a tension or clash between what might seem to be simply more or less of the same quality? We can begin to understand this if we approach it on a lower level, taking the tension as being between the spiritual insight represented by Avalokiteshvara and the more intellectual type of understanding represented by Shariputra, even though we cannot, as we shall see, lean on this interpretation too heavily. There is, moreover, something quite unusual and significant about this dialogue or confrontation, at least in the shorter version of the Heart Sutra. This is that Shariputra doesn't say a word. In other words, in the context of the Heart Sutra, the intellect doesn't answer back as it usually does. It has reached the point where it is able to transcend itself. There is a saying from the Christian mystical tradition, "Reason dies in giving birth to ecstasy." We can say here that wisdom dies in giving birth to perfect wisdom. Here, represented in the Heart Sutra, is, in a way, the central situation of the spiritual life. Wisdom in the process of becoming perfect wisdom. The Dharmas in the process of being dissolved into shunyata. Intellectual understanding in the process of being transformed into spiritual insight. When we read the sutra, when we recite it, when we reflect upon it, we are addressing a dramatic situation that is not taking place outside us at all. Sariputra is inside us. Avalokiteshvara, too, is inside us. The Sariputra in us must learn to listen to the Avalokiteshvara in us. In this way, the form of the sutra says dramatically what its content says didactically. The literary form speaks in terms of images and is directed at the unconscious. The content, on the other hand, uses concepts and addresses the conscious mind. This conceptual content consists mainly in six great statements made by Avalokiteshvara, six thunderclaps which progressively shatter all Sariputra's prejudices, destroying the lower wisdom and revealing the higher wisdom. Avalokita, the Holy Lord and Bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. He looked down from on high. He beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. Hear, O Sariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. The first statement made by Avalokiteshvara is that the five skandhas are empty. This statement represents common ground between himself and Sariputra. Both Hinayana and Mahayana start from this point. According to this fundamental Buddhist teaching, the entire range of existent phenomena can be reduced to five groups or aggregates, which are material form, feelings, pleasant, painful, and neutral, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Whether one is dealing with things or persons, one can discuss them completely, exhaustively, in terms of these five categories. It isn't necessary to bring in any such separate independent category as a self or a soul. What we call the self is not anything independent of the skandhas. It is not something separate from form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. The self is only a label for the skandhas in their collective aspect. This first great statement is that the five skandhas exhaust the whole of existence, and that there is nothing beyond them. At the same time, they are empty of any self or soul. Hear, O Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. Avalokiteshvara's second great statement goes a bit further. All dharmas, he now says, are empty. Here we begin to get into deep water. The early Buddhist classification of the whole existence under the headings of the five skandhas was rejected by the Abhidharma tradition, of which Sariputra was said to be the founder. It was not, you might say, quite scientific enough for the Abhidharma. So they replaced the original five skandha classification with a fourfold one, into form, thought, mental concomitants, and miscellaneous, each of which was subdivided again and again. The ultimate subdivisions of these four categories, the irreducible elements beyond which analysis cannot go, they call the dharmas. The Sarvastivada, perhaps the most important school of the Hinayana, made out that there were 72 of these dharmas, the ultimate irreducible elements into which the whole of phenomenal conditioned existence can be reduced. These are known as the conditioned dharmas, to distinguish them from a much shorter list of just three unconditioned dharmas, consisting of space and the two kinds of nirvana. These unconditioned dharmas were seen as eternal, and as not arising by way of cause and effect, as did the conditioned dharmas. Altogether, these made up the famous 75 dharmas of the Sarvastivada. The philosophy is a form of pluralistic realism. The early Abhidharma philosophers had a great deal of fun classifying and cataloguing their dharmas in all sorts of different ways. They sorted out conditioned dharmas from unconditioned ones. They distinguished dharmas that were defiled by greed, hatred and delusion from undefiled dharmas, and dharmas which were limited or incomplete from those which were infinite or complete. They noted how every conditioned dharma was produced and then stopped, whereas unconditioned dharmas were characterized solely by nirodha, or stopping. Scores upon scores of different types of relationship between dharmas were worked out, giving tens of thousands of permutations and forming an enormously elaborate structure. It is hard to conceive just how elaborate this structure was, but the results fill volume after volume after volume of analysis and coordination of dharmas. Avalokiteshvara asserts that all these dharmas are empty. They are not ultimately real. With this statement, he dismisses the whole scholastic apparatus of the Abhidharma. The entire edifice is empty. It's all right as far as it goes. It takes us beyond the gross delusion that things are things and persons are persons. But as a system of analysis and classification, it is a product of the subtle activity of the mind, and as such it represents a subtle delusion which must ultimately be transcended. Perfect wisdom, represented by Avalokiteshvara, destroys not only the Abhidharma, but all attempts, both philosophical and scientific, to give a systematic intellectual account of reality. The only way you can get to reality is by destroying your ideas about reality, however subtle, however sophisticated, however convincing they may be. Their validity can only ever be provisional. So, all dharmas are empty. Therefore, O Sariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or objects of mind. No sight organ element, and so forth, until we come to no mind conscious element. Third statement. In Shunyata, no dharmas exist. This is the corollary, the more positive counterpart, if you like, of the previous statement. It suggests that reality is quite bare, quite pure, devoid of all our intellectual constructions, all our philosophies, all our concepts. These ideas are ours. They do not belong to reality, for reality knows nothing about them. Reality rejects, to anthropomorphize a little, all our thoughts. In Shunyata there is no distinguishing whatsoever between conditioned dharmas and unconditioned dharmas, or defiled dharmas and pure dharmas. All such dualisms are transcended. It is like, to use a favorite image of the Mahayana, the unclouded sky. Clouds may be very beautiful, but they obscure the naked brilliance of the sky itself. Reality, in its true state, above and beyond all our systems of thought about it, is like the clear, cloudless sky. In Shunyata, no dharmas exist. there is no ignorance, nor extinction of ignorance, and so forth, until we come to there is no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death. There is no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. There is no cognition, no attainment, and no non-attainment. Philosophy, even Buddhist philosophy, has been disposed of. Do we imagine then that religion, even Buddhism itself, is going to escape? Avalokiteshvara's fourth great statement is to the effect that there is no such thing as Buddhism. I'm paraphrasing a little, and this fourth statement is really a broader and more universal version of the third one, but this is what it comes to. He eliminates religion considered as an end in itself. There is nothing absolute or ultimate about religion. So in this part of the sutra, various well-known categories of Buddhist thought are enumerated. The five skandhas, the six sense organs, the 18 elements, the 12 links of the chain of dependent origination, the four noble truths, knowledge itself, attainment, and even non-attainment. The last two items, prapti and aprapti, differ from the rest in that they are terms that do not occur in the Pali canon. They were introduced by the Savastivadins as a category of the sanskaras, and as such they represent an extreme example of abstract concepts being rarefied. Avalokiteshvara declares all these philosophical and even practical religious categories, all the operative bases of our religious life, including the idea of conditioned co-production, and even the idea of enlightenment itself, to be shunya, void, without ultimate reality. He is saying that if you want to develop, if your goal is perfect wisdom, well, you have to go beyond Buddhism. In reality, you have to realize there is no such thing as Buddhism. Buddhism is only a raft to take you to the other shore. Then it must be abandoned. It is only a finger pointing to the moon. At this point, the Zen connection with the Heart Sutra, or rather the way the Heart Sutra works itself out practically in terms of Zen, is unmistakable. The Zen master who replied to the question, "Suppose I met the Buddha on the road, what should I do?" with the terse instruction, "Kill him," was telling his pupil that he had to leave Buddhism behind. If you are really set on enlightenment, don't let the concept of the Buddha get in the way. There is nothing that hinders you in your search for reality so much as that which is there to help you, namely religion. What should be a means to an end is so easily taken for an end in itself. Buddhism is probably unique in seeing this so lucidly. It sweeps the path to enlightenment clear, even of Buddhism itself. No doubt you need Buddhism for a long time. You need your mantras and your meditations, your chanting and your scriptures, your lectures and retreats and seminars, and you need to use Buddhist terms and ideas. But in the end, you have to go beyond the limits of their guidance, sweeping it all aside to encounter reality alone. Therefore, O Sariputra, it is because of his indifference to any kind of personal attainment, and through his reliance on the perfection of wisdom, that a bodhisattva dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. He has overcome what can upset, and in the end he attains to nirvana. Fifth great statement, the bodhisattva gains enlightenment and becomes a Buddha only by relying on perfect wisdom. There is no other way. You cannot become enlightened unless you develop perfect wisdom. You may be a great scholar, you may be deeply versed in the techniques of concentration and meditation. You may be very devoted, pious and full of faith. You may be forever doing good works, even to the extent of giving your own life for the sake of others. But none of these worthwhile attainments are ultimately any help. Only perfect wisdom, in the sense of direct, face-to-face knowledge of ultimate reality, beyond Buddhism itself, will confer enlightenment. All those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, fully awake to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of wisdom. The sixth and last statement is that all Buddhas of the past, present, and future gain enlightenment through the development of perfect wisdom. There are no exceptions. If there are any enlightened persons of the past, of the present, or of the future, they have become, or will become, enlightened only by the development of perfect wisdom. Here the Heart Sutra is absolutely, ruthlessly unambiguous. These six statements represent the main content of the Heart Sutra. There's just one more thing. The sutra concludes with the mantra of perfect wisdom. And just as the sutra condenses the Prajnaparamita literature, so the mantra condenses the sutra itself. Khonsa translates mantra as spell, but that is completely misleading. A mantra is a sort of sacred utterance. One can't really offer any more explanation of it than that. The mantra of perfect wisdom is gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi swaha. Mantras are not really translatable, but according to Khonsa's translation, one can render this as gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening! All hail! The bare meaning of the words doesn't help us very much, however. The first gate means gone from the conditioned, gone from the phenomenal world, from the world as we know it. The second gate means gone even from the unconditioned, even from nirvana, that is, gone from the concept of nirvana or enlightenment as something distinct from this world and this state. It isn't enough to go beyond the conditioned, you have to go beyond the unconditioned. It isn't enough, we may say, to overcome Satan, you have to overcome God too. Then, paragate means gone beyond. Gone beyond the distinction of conditioned and unconditioned, samsara and nirvana, this world and that, defiled and undefiled. Gone beyond all dualistic distinctions whatsoever. Parasangate, gone altogether beyond, means that one goes beyond the conception even of shunyata. When one leaves behind the conception of reality itself, then one has gone altogether beyond. The next word, bodhi, is not a statement of any kind. It means enlightenment, Buddhahood, knowledge of the ultimate. But the mantra is not saying, oh, and then you realize bodhi. It is not even really saying, oh, what an awakening. This is not bad, but it misses the force of the single word bodhi, awakening. Finally, swaha is untranslatable, but its general meaning in Indian literature is all is well, auspiciousness, blessing. When you have awoken, when you are a Buddha, well, everything is completely auspicious, all is well. This then is the heart or essence of the Heart Sutra, which is itself a distillation of the meaning of the entire perfection of wisdom scriptures. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond, awakening, all is well. Constantly reciting the mantra, constantly meditating on it, eventually one assimilates its deep meaning. In the case of the Prajnaparamita sadhana, or visualization practice, the mantra is different. In this context, it is Om Adhi Hung Swaha, which invokes the Bodhisattva Pranayaparamita. But Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhiswaha is the mantra of wisdom itself. It is a sort of impersonal mantra, as it were. If you didn't want to meditate on a particular Bodhisattva form, you could take this mantra, or indeed any verses or passages from the Perfection of Wisdom literature. The similes at the end of the Diamond Sutra would do very well, and reflect on their meaning. In doing that, you would be calling to mind verses or mantras which embody the Perfection of Wisdom orally, instead of invoking a visual or formal embodiment of it. The Heart Sutra as a whole is quite compact enough for regular recitation and reflection. In the way I have demonstrated it, the sutra represents a path of regular steps, but it would not be a bad idea to break down these six stages into a number of smaller stages. For instance, you don't need to plunge into the five skandhas cold. You could start, perhaps, with the division of the person into nama and rupa. Then you could break nama and rupa down into its four constituent parts, so to speak, to arrive at the five skandhas, rupa being the fifth. From there, you could go on to deal with the 12 ayatanas, the six senses and their objects, and the 18 dhatus, the 12 ayatanas plus the respective consciousness that arises in dependence on the contact of each sense with its object. There is no need to start speculating as to the whys and wherefores of these various classifications. Originally, they were intended not as any kind of statement of an epistemological doctrine, but simply as a framework for meditation. The idea is that on the basis of a deeply concentrated and positive meditative state, you simply turn your attention to your own being, and by analysing it in this way, start trying to see yourself as a complex process instead of as a self. Going further, you can approach the dharmas more systematically by distinguishing between Sanskrita dharmas and Asanskrita dharmas, compounded and uncompounded dharmas, and then proceed to the Abhidharma-type classification of chittas, consciousnesses, and chaitasikas, mental concomitants. Finally, you can relate each successive gate in the mantra to a different level of shunyata in the way I have outlined. In a way, one has to recapitulate Shariputra's progress. One has got to be Shariputra fully before one can start listening to Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara's statements represent not the exploding of an error or the removal of a wrong understanding, but the deepening of a limited understanding. If that limited understanding were not there to begin with, it could not be deepened. Some exceptional individuals might make the leap into the Perfection of Wisdom from nowhere, but they are very rare, and one cannot assume that one belongs to that class oneself. Avalokiteshvara is addressing someone who has reached a definite level of understanding. But what level are we really talking about? We need to be clear, to begin with, that we are dealing with the Shariputra of Mahayanistic myth, not with the historical Shariputra. And to be fair to the myth, it does not suggest that Shariputra represents a merely intellectual understanding of the Dharma, because, after all, the Abhidharma itself distinguishes between Shruta Mayi Pranya, wisdom based on book learning, and Bhavana Mayi Pranya, wisdom based on direct meditative experience. If we are going to take up the Heart Sutra at all, however, we have to accept on some level the Mahayana distinction between the limited insight of an arahant and the deeper insight of the Pranayaparamita, even if in the end the distinction does not bear very close scrutiny. It is probably best to regard Shariputra as representing that aspect of the mind which tends to take things literally, and Avalokiteshvara as the aspect which goes to the heart of things. For the purposes of communication, of course, you need both the letter of the teaching and the spirit. This is as true for the perfection of wisdom teachings as it is for the Abhidharma. The Mahayana warns us not to take shunyata as a thing, but as an operational concept, since otherwise we would find in it yet another home for the ego. Even the so-called ultimate psychophysical elements of the Abhidharma were operational concepts originally, however. It is not the depth of our analysis that matters, so much as the spirit in which we take its results. After all, although there is an explicit awareness of the limitations of conceptual formulations in the Mahayana Buddhist world, this is no absolute insurance against a spiritual hardening of the arteries and a decline into literalism. No copy of a Sanskrit text of the Heart Sutra has ever been found in India, but at the end of the 19th century, an original Indian palm leaf manuscript of the Sanskrit text was unearthed in a Japanese temple. It was not in fact a Zen temple, but this is no great surprise, for the Heart Sutra is recited and meditated upon in many different schools of Japanese Buddhism. They generally chant it in Japanese quite fast and rhythmically, just as in Tibet it is chanted in Tibetan, and in England and the USA it is spoken in English, and sometimes also chanted in the original Sanskrit. The perfection of wisdom tradition has had a strong influence on both Tibetan Buddhism and Zen. The Tibetan approach to it is more dialectical. Tibetan Buddhists tend to be rather intellectual, and the Zen approach is more intuitive, more poetic. But in both schools, the Heart Sutra, along with the Diamond Sutra, is highly esteemed. One of the greatest of Zen, or more strictly Chan, masters, Han Shan, wrote particularly beautiful commentaries on both these texts, which have now been published in English in a very illuminating translation by Charles Luke. We may go as far as to say that the Heart Sutra, together with the Diamond Sutra, constitutes the spiritual backbone of the Buddhism of China, Japan, Mongolia, Tibet, Korea, and Vietnam. The health of the backbone does not in itself, of course, guarantee the spiritual health of the whole body of the Far Eastern Buddhist tradition. Zen and Tibetan practitioners are just as likely to be narrow-minded, dogmatic, bigoted, and literalistic as any Theravadin. There is a tendency towards literalism in all schools of Buddhism because it is a tendency of the human mind itself. Perhaps it is time we had a new sutra, one in which the place of Sariputra is taken by Avalokiteshvara, an Avalokiteshvara who has taken the categories of the Mahayana literally and needs to have the real meaning of shunyata revealed to him by a higher being. In the meantime, we can continue this tradition in the West, not by merely looking at words on a page, but by learning to listen to the voice of Avalokiteshvara in our own hearts, and waiting for the flower of perfect wisdom to bloom there.